You are listening to KHUHLP 104.9 FM, Seattle. This is the Thunderbolt for January 31st, 2020. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. This is a fifth Friday, meaning that it's time for the Thunderbolt's greatest strikes. And this week's show barely fits into my new time format, so we're going to get right to it here without all the usual bells and whistles. This is Revolutionary Lessons. Enjoy. To quote George Orwell, "He who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the future." The story that we tell ourselves about who we are is very important. Telling the American story is somewhat problematic due to the fact that basically our ancestors stole an entire continent by conducting a genocidal slaughter upon the native inhabitants and enslaving millions of other people to do the hard work. The fact that this has been turned into a noble and glorious accomplishment is a great credit to American propagandists. Well, I think that in order to become all that we can be, we need to be honest about where we have been. And I think we should acknowledge both the good and the bad. Now, my theory may be wrong, but I think honesty is usually the best policy. And that is why I am such an iconoclast. That is why I gut sacred cows with such enthusiasm. Now, the American Revolution was indeed quite revolutionary for its time. And those people did take some very serious risks. The Founding Fathers created not only a political revolution, but they radically altered the very philosophy underlying the relations between government and the people. But as brilliant and as radical as the Founding Fathers were, their hypocrisy was also astonishing. The creator of the phrase, "all men are created equal," owned human slaves. Now, Thomas Jefferson said and wrote some of the coolest shite that has ever been said and written in all human history. But Jefferson was one of the most cutthroat and effective backstabbers, i.e. one of the most accomplished politicians in all human history. Now, to be fair, the reality at that time and place was quite different than it is now. And pretty much all politicos in all eras always play such games.
Afraid to see, but I close my eyes.
Vicious games, vicious games.
Anyway, the American Revolution largely consisted of American aristocrats hiring American rabble to fight hired British rabble so that the American aristocrats could stop being ripped off by the East India Company. In many ways, they were not nice people, even considering the context. For instance, the horrific treatment that was meted out to the loyalists i.e. the 30% of the American population who thought that splitting from England might not be such a hot idea, their treatment was totally unforgivable. During the Revolution,
with different names.
George Washington lived in decadent comfort while his troops froze.
With different names.
He ate catered luxury meals while his troops starved.
Now that you've gone and you have left me, I had to learn. I had to learn how much it hurts.
He often yelled at and beat enlisted men, and he ruthlessly executed deserters. After the war, the government ripped off all the soldiers, and when they returned home, many of them discovered that while they had been freezing the front of their backsides at Valley Forge, Alexander Hamilton's gangster buddies had been stealing all of their homes and throwing all of their families out onto the streets. These outrages eventually culminated into Shay's Rebellion, which was brutally suppressed by federal troops. Then, when a bunch of other veterans got pissed at being ripped off, they organized what was called the Whiskey Rebellion, since it was largely a protest against a crippling whiskey tax. In this case, George Washington personally led American troops not only against American citizens, but against veterans who had endured insanity to win Washington's revolution for him. This was the only instance in our entire history wherein a president personally led troops into the field, and it was against American veterans. One prop that I will give to George Washington: as far as I can figure, up to that time, George Washington was one of the only, if not the only, head of state to ever voluntarily give up power. When Washington announced that he would be voluntarily stepping down as president, his nemesis, King George III, stated that Washington had been, quote, placed in a light the most distinguished of any man living, and that he was, quote, the greatest character of the age. And one other prop I will give to George Washington: he did not abuse his demigod status nearly as much as he could have. I think George Washington knew full well that he had carved out quite the legend for himself, and I believe that he did not want to do anything stupid during the last phase of his career to mess that up. And so, other than marching troops on American veterans, he was otherwise mostly Mr. Cautious, don't rock the boat during his time as president. Then, John Adams won the presidency in 1796, but after a bruising, down and dirty, mud-slinging election in 1800, that makes our modern elections seem genteel and modest by comparison, Thomas Jefferson and his acolytes James Madison and James Monroe used their velvet-covered iron Virginia fists to grasp control of the executive branch of the American government, and then they firmly held on to it for the next 24 years. At the time, it seemed as if the Jeffersonian farmer-agrarian vision of America had won out over the Adams-Hamiltonian vision of an industrial America dominated by economic elites. Dream on.
There'll be no one to stop us this time.
Another player in this game was Aaron Burr. Now, Mr. Burr was one of George Washington's soldiers at Valley Forge, and Mr. Burr was probably involved in the Conway Cabal, which is an effort to replace George Washington as the commanding general. For in addition to being an arrogant and classist a-hole, George Washington was also probably one of the worst generals ever to win a war. And actually, the French won the American Revolution anyway, so saying that Washington won it isn't even accurate to begin with. During the few instances where Washington actually stopped running away from the British long enough to stand and fight them, he got his butt kicked nearly every time. Though, to be honest, it was actually his troops that got their butts kicked nearly every time. Now, the troops of other American generals, such as Horatio Gates and Charles Lee, actually won most of their battles. But while they were accomplished generals, Gates and Lee were lousy politicians. They tended to call two-faced jerks, two-faced jerks. And since most politicians are two-faced jerks, then Gates and Lee suffered in the public relations department as a result. George Washington, on the other hand, had the politics down. He flattered and kissed.
You are not a Jedi. Get
all of the proper rear ends. And he made all the proper, quote, friends, unquote. And thus came out on top in the end. Now, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton were political allies, but they loathed each other on a personal level. Both of those things,
you are not a Jedi yet,
can also be said about Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. Political enemies Jefferson and Hamilton often commiserated with each other over their mutual loathing of Aaron Burr, as did political enemies Thomas Jefferson and John Adams over their mutual personal nemesis, Alexander Hamilton. Anyway, after several months of vicious file mudslinging, the incredibly foul election of 1800 resulted in ostensible allies Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each tied with 73 electoral votes. Ironically, this left the decision of who would be the next president to the House of Representatives, which was, at this point, still under the control of the now lame duck Federalist Party, who were thus tasked with choosing which Democratic Republican enemy would assume the presidency. Both candidates were utterly loathsome some to the Federalists. And for almost a week, the House cast a total of 35 ballots, with both Jefferson and Burr receiving just shy of the number of votes needed to win. Then, Jefferson and Burr engaged in some sort of backroom deal whereby Burr would whisper in the proper New England ears to allow Jefferson to win the election in exchange for some unknown future consideration. Most historians think that Jefferson promised some kind of support for something at some future time, but no one ever really kissed and told on that one. So the facts surrounding this alleged deal are merely alleged facts. Now, Aaron Burr was an ambitious politician who was neither much better nor much worse than any of his contemporaries. But his name was destined to become shrouded in rumors and controversy. However, of all the rogues who gave us our country, Aaron Burr has always been one of my personal favorites. This fondness is due partly to his controversial nature, but there were also several other things. He was a feminist, for one thing. Now, most people do know that shortly after assuming the vice presidency, Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, which means that Dick Cheney was not the first American vice president to shoot someone while in office.
All aboard, said Captain Tom, we're sailing west, we're here away. You better leave your hose at home when Jolly Roger's laughing through the rain.
I got the map, I got the plan, a wooden leg and a hairy chest. I may be blind, I may be deaf, but you will know I am the best. Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum, we're sailing west into the sun. Of hell and hurricanes, no gold, no women, no cocaine. And Captain Tom has gone insane, and Jolly Roger's laughing through the rain. The show is already here for the meal. Save your ass and stash your cash. The balls and nerves are made of steel. We suck the bones and rotten flesh.
Now, what most people do not know is that the reason Aaron Burr called Alexander Hamilton out was because Hamilton had publicly conjectured that Burr was having sexual relations with his own daughter, Theodosia. Now, it is important to understand that at that time and at that place, and under the code of honor by which these men lived, calling out Hamilton
into the sun
for such an egregious slander
into the sun
was Burr's only possible recourse.
Into the sun.
Now, concerning Burr's daughter, Theodosia, Burr's beloved wife had died in 1793, and Aaron Burr never remarried until much later in his life. Now, during the period in question, Theodosia became Burr's social secretary, hostess, and confidant. Aaron
Aaron Burr educated his daughter in a manner that was almost completely unprecedented at the time, and Theodosia could effectively debate on many topics, even with the likes of Thomas Jefferson. Now, Theodosia was always at Burr's side, and he trusted her with every aspect of everything that was happening during these very intense and very exciting times. The one comment that everyone who knew them made was that Aaron and Theodosia Burr very obviously adored each other. And it seems probable that this situation was at least partly responsible for Alexander Hamilton's erroneous and eventually fatal conjecture about the nature of their relationship. Now, while Aaron Burr won the duel, he lost his career. Alexander Hamilton became a martyr, while Aaron Burr was condemned, lied about, and vilified. The actual reason for the duel was not widely known, and Aaron Burr did not want the reason to be widely known, and so the Hamilton-Burr duel was widely considered to be the simple elimination of a political rival by means most foul. Aaron Burr's rep was toast. And then, after the duel, Thomas Jefferson saw his opportunity to kick a dog that was already down, and he not only squelched on whatever deal he had made with Aaron Burr, but Jefferson later had Burr railroaded into court on a totally fabricated bull-fucking charge of treason. For after his ostracism, Aaron Burr had gone to Tennessee, whereupon he started raising an army with which he planned to invade Mexico, whereupon he planned to make himself the Emperor of Mexico, whereupon he planned to ally himself with the United States. He figured that under this scenario, then the quote, good guys, i.e. English white people, would then have complete dominion over the entirety of North America. But this plan was squelched when Thomas Jefferson suborned perjury and manufactured evidence in an effort to prosecute Burr by alleging that Burr was raising this army in order to invade the United States. It was a completely preposterous charge, and everyone who knew Aaron Burr understood that he was not stupid enough to do such a thing, even if he had had any such inclination to do such a thing in the first place, which he most certainly did not. And even though Aaron Burr was eventually acquitted of all charges, Jefferson's move utterly destroyed any political ambition that Jefferson's ambitious rival Aaron Burr might have still possessed. Bada boom. So Theodosia had married in 1801, becoming Theodosia Burr Alston. Then, In 1812, Theodosia set sail on a ship that subsequently disappeared at sea without a trace. Now, many legends subsequently grew up around this happenstance, and the legend of Theodosia's disappearance is an interesting story in and of itself. Aaron Burr ended up surviving until 1836. Thus, Mr. Burr outlived all of his rivals by a goodly amount. Aaron Burr subsequently spent his waning years living as something of a gigolo, hustling rich widows, and enjoying the life of a celebrity bon vivant. Thus, after his fall from grace, and after recovering from the loss of his beloved daughter, Aaron Burr, at least, seems to enjoy the rest of his life. And I guess that ultimately, that means that Aaron Burr won the game. So that's it for Revolutionary Lessons Part 1. Tune in to the August 19th show for Revolutionary Lessons Part 2. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams.
And actually, since this is a rerun, you only need to wait for a quick station break to hear the next part. So stay tuned.
The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views, and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of KHUH-FM, nor anyone that has anything to do with KHUH-FM. And now, back to the Thunderbolt.
All right, moving right along here. For the August 5th show, I aired a Thunderbolt called Revolutionary Lessons Part 1. It was a somewhat iconoclastic view of the American Revolution, and the title of that piece would seem to imply that a Part 2 would follow. And indeed, I promised Part 2 at the end of Part 1, but we have since decided Revolutionary Lessons Part 2 should be about the aspects of the American Revolution that we don't know about. And since we don't know about them, then I can't talk about them. And so I'm afraid that Revolutionary Lessons Part 2 will have to exist somewhere in some other dimension that maybe we can access someday. But that means that we will skip right to Revolutionary Lessons, Part 3. One of the most fascinating exchanges between public officials that I have ever checked out was the correspondence that occurred betwixt Thomas Jefferson and John Adams during the waning years of their lives. Now, to understand this exchange, you will need some context. During the American Revolution, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had been personal friends. Adams was, in point of fact,
something of a mentor to Thomas Jefferson. And in point of fact, it was Adams who had drafted Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. However, once the United States was up and running, it turned out that their visions of what the country should be were utterly and diametrically opposed. Basically, Thomas Jefferson was an anarchist, whilst John Adams was a fascist. Thomas Jefferson was the pastoral farmer, whilst John Adams was a capitalist industrialist. Thomas Jefferson was the utopian dreamer, whilst John Adams was of the practical realpolitik school of thought. Thomas Jefferson believed that humanity was good at heart and able to take care of themselves, whilst John Adams thought that humanity was depraved at heart and needed an iron fist to keep them civilized. During his administration, Adams actually made it illegal to criticize him, and he threw numerous newspaper editors into prison for doing so.
Mother
boo. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson became near mortal enemies during the election of 1800. And when Jefferson eventually won, Adams did not even bother to stick around long enough to attend Jefferson's inaugural and swearing-in ceremony. After this, they neither spake nor did they correspond for the next 12 years. Finally, in 1812, Adams contacted Jefferson and thus began their historic correspondence that continued until nearly the end of their lives. Mostly, they discussed their mutual invention, the United States of America. Both men obviously had the ulterior motive of putting the American Revolution on the record, so to speak. But it is also obvious that they both felt a very powerful personal desire to justify each to the other, for Adams and Jefferson were almost literally the definition of an odd couple. One conclusion they both readily acknowledged, though, was that each of them was incomplete without the other, that they were two faces of the same coin. One observer had called them the North and South Poles of the American Revolution. Both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were off the hook in their various, very different manners, but they actually balanced each other out very nicely, and in the end, they were both smart enough to realize it. But whatever else you want to say about them, just remember this. More than anyone else, it was John Adams and Thomas Jefferson who were the central driving force behind the writing of the Declaration of Independence. And signing that document was a very serious thing. An alarmingly large number of the signers ended up losing everything that they had as a result of their act. 17 of the 56 signers of the Declaration, for instance, were financially wiped out by the war that they had declared and they ended up dying in poverty. Four of them lost all of their children as a result. And every single one of them eventually had to flee their homes at one point or another. And after the war, 12 of them returned to find their homes in rubble. And so on. And in addition to all of that, had England won the war, all of the survivors would very likely have faced execution. Yes, kids, these guys were placing very large bets and taking a very large risk, and they do indeed deserve some props for that. So anyway, of all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson and Adams were also destined to become the last two survivors. And then, incredibly, they not only both died on the very same day, but, incredibly, the day that they both died was July 4th, 1826, which was, incredibly, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Huh. Incredible. Who says that magic does not happen? As foul as I consider such a large portion of the American experiment to be, even I must admit that there was some pretty powerful stuff going on during those exciting times. And one more little observation on the Jefferson Adams thing. It is said that Adams' dying words were, "Jefferson yet lives." If so, then that meant that this was Adams' very last concern. If so, then that meant that it was very likely that it seriously bugged John Adams that Jefferson was surviving him. Now keep in mind, for the rest of their adult lives, the United States had been ruled by the Jeffersonian vision. The Virginia Junta were not dislodged from the White House until 1824. And for this entire time, Jefferson was considered to be an American hero, while Adams was considered to be something of an embarrassment. And now, even in the great final game, it appeared as if Jefferson had beat Adams even on that ground. And the joke in all of this, of course, is the fact that in yet another example of pure irony, Jefferson had actually ended up dying a few hours before Adams did, and thus in the end, Adams did achieve his final concern. He did survive Jefferson. He just never knew it. Now, Thomas Jefferson's dying concern was whether or not it was the 4th of July yet. When informed that it was indeed the 4th of July, Thomas Jefferson reportedly smiled and then promptly died. On his way out, I can imagine Mr. Jefferson smiling to himself and saying, "Cool, I did good. Now I'm done. Catch you all down the road."
That's it for the news and commentary section. And while we're being all historical here and stuff, then for the music portion of the Seattle show, let's say we go to some rather unsavory pre-American history. This is Charlie Murphy.
In the cool of the evening, they used to gather near the stars in the middle circle near an old oak tree at the times appointed by the seasons of the year and the phases of the moon. In the center stood a woman, equal with the others and respected for her worth. One of the many we call the witches, the healers and the teachers of the wisdom of the earth. And the people grew through the knowledge she gave them, herbs to heal their bodies, spells to make their spirits whole. Can't you hear them chanting, healing incantations, calling forth the wise ones, celebrating in dance and song. As a star to Diana, Hecate to Demeter, Kali, Inanna. Isis the star to Diana, Hecate to Demeter, Kali, Inanna. Isis the star to Diana, Hecate to Demeter, Kali, Inanna. They were those who came to power through domination, and they bonded in the worship of a dead man on a cross. They sought control of the common people by demanding allegiance to the Church of Rome. And the Pope declared an inquisition. It was war against the women whose power they feared. In this holocaust against the nature people, 9 million European women died. And the tale is told of those who by the hundreds, holding together, chose their death in the sea, while chanting the praises of the mother goddess, a refusal of betrayal, women were dying to be free.
Still burn her, stripping her down with mining and the poisons of their war. So to us, the earth is a healer, a teacher, a mother, a weaver of a web of light that keeps us all alive. She gives us the vision to see through the chaos. She gives us the courage, it is our will to survive.
That girl! she's acting so wild. But she used to be me, and she's somebody's child. Spare a little thought for the down and out, 'cause it's true. If the tables were turned, if the deal was different, it might be you. Look at that man, he lives in his car, 'cause a run of bad luck went and pushed him too far. And the woman who lives in a box at the back, when she started out, did her dreams include that? So spare a little thought for the down and out, 'cause it's true. If the tables were turned and the deal was different, it might be you. So leave them on the streets if their families don't care. We've got crow's feet to fill, we've got no cash to spare. The food lines are endless, the shelters are full, and such are the things they don't teach you in school.
Bought me a congressman. He was cheaper than a Subaru. He needed money for his next campaign. Now he'll do anything I ask him to. 20 years on Capitol Hill, he pretends to do the people's will. But I got him in my pocket now. Well, that's the way the game is played. I got lobbyists in my pay. They're on the Hill nearly every day, writing bills that the senator signed. They never read them, but I don't mind. Koch brothers bought a whole damn crew. They own governors and presidents too. Now they're working on the rich man's dream. 9 judges out of 9 supremes. Well, that's business in the USA. Buying senators is all the rage. Big money owns a whole damn show, and we the people get the shaft. But the people now are getting wise. You can see it in their angry eyes. Had enough of all the tricks and lies, and now they're loaded for bear. Party and the liberals too, both stewing in the same damn stew. Big money screwing me and you, and it's time we change the game. So keep voting if you think you should. The illusion might do you good, but you gotta know the whole game's rigged. Politicians don't give a fig. We had enough of this plutocracy. We can't whine and just let it be. The whole Congress is a den of thieves, and we gotta send them home. So get your pitchforks and torches now. Well, that's the only way to push them out. Standing tall on the Capitol Mall. Raise a ruckus now and sound the call. We gotta get out on the streets today. Bare knuckle. knuckles is the only way. We the people gotta have our say. And you better listen up. Well, that's business in the USA. Buying senators is all the rage. Big money owns a whole damn show. And we the people got the shaft. But the people now are on the rise. You can see it in our angry eyes. We had enough of all the tricks and lies. Now we're loaded for bear. We the people gonna have our say. And you better listen up.
That was Loaded for Bear from Mudcat, Somebody's Child from Judith Owen, Rebel Girl from Bikini Kill, and The Burning Times from Charlie Murphy. We'll see you next week. The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt. Nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com. And we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day. And please note that the Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes. Or you can now go directly to the Thunderbolt WordPress site, which is at dana98501.wordpress.com.
Thank you very much.